The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the small intestine is presented by Dr. Catherine Kirchin.
All right, so I got my slides changed a little bit, so you might have a few more pictures on this presentation. I thought something was missing that first lecture. So there's a whole bunch of things to cover in malabsorption or in the small bowel, including malabsorption. So we'll get going. I included a couple things with minerals and vitamins and stuff like that that are a good thing to review before exams. It's one of those things you just need to memorize. So I did include some of that in your packets for those of you that are actually taking the exam. So malabsorption can occur at different phases. It's clicking. So there's the luminal phase, okay, mucosal phase, and delivery phase. So a couple examples for the luminal phase would be pancreatic insufficiency, where you're using digestive enzymes to break down the food. Mucosal phase would be substances that are assimilated and absorbed in the required constituent form. So examples of that would be celiac disease, which we'll talk more about, and then Crohn's disease, which you'll get a lecture about later. Delivery phase would be in situations like lymphoma, where nutrients are taken up into the cytoplasm and transported to the lymphatic or portal venous system. So different areas where malabsorption can be occurring, and we'll touch on a few of them, but obviously not all of them today. So one of the more common symptoms of malabsorption is diarrhea. Again, different mechanisms for diarrhea: decreased absorption, which would be a villus function, or increased secretion, a crypt function. I've divided it up, as you've seen when you read about different forms of diarrhea. So you have inflammatory, non-inflammatory, secretory, osmotic, and trying to keep track of what's what. So the inflammatory diarrhea, the patient may have abdominal pain, fever, tenesmus. The stools are usually have mucus in them. They're mucoid, bloody, smaller volumes of stool. And there's blood and leukocytes microscopically. Non-inflammatory tends to produce more watery diarrhea, typically no fever or gross bleeding, and the stools will appear normal when they're evaluated under the microscope. Secretory and osmotic are other categories of diarrhea. So with secretory, it'll either be small and or large intestinal fluid and electrolyte secretion. If the patient stops eating, they'll continue to have diarrhea with secretory. So a good question to ask patients: if you don't eat anything, does it make a difference with your diarrhea? And then the osmotic gap would be less than 50. Again, that's very general. There's a lot of mixed conditions and stuff, but just remember 50. And then with osmotic, you have ingestion of poorly absorbed cations, anions, sugars, or sugar alcohols. And if the diarrhea will stop if they're not eating. So stop with fasting, yes. And then the stool osmotic gap in purely osmotic diarrhea would be greater than 100. So we'll go over a couple different kinds of general malabsorption, then we'll get into some of the specific diseases that can cause malabsorption. Carbohydrate malabsorption is the mechanisms: you get a reduction of mucosal surface area, reduced disaccharides, and transport proteins. The most common in this category that you may see is lactose malabsorption. There are different types of lactose deficiency. You can have congenital, primary or delayed, and then late onset or acquired. Usually you see that in patients that have intestinal like resections or mucosal diseases, patients that have had some type of infection, a post-infectious lactose intolerance. Clinical presentation of carbohydrate malabsorption would be increased gas, distension, possibly diarrhea. Getting a good dietary history on these patients may help determine the cause of their malabsorption problem. Different tests that you can do, a fecal pH less than 6 is evidence of carbohydrate malabsorption. You can also do hydrogen breath tests that are, you know, available in a lot of communities. An increase of 20 parts per million, colonic fermentation of the lactose by bacteria. You can have false positives and false negatives with this the test, so you do have to be careful about how you're interpreting them. False positives can occur in the setting of bacterial overgrowth, and then false negatives you can get if a patient's recently been on antibiotics. You can also do what we call an avoidance trial, and that's basically having your patient get off all lactose and see if their symptoms improve, then reintroduce the lactose in small quantities to see if there's a certain amount that they can tolerate. Protein losing enteropathy, there's three reasons for GI protein loss. One would be increased mucosal permeability. A common situation would be celiac sprue, H. pylori. We also see in eosinophilic conditions, vasculitis. Mucosal erosions that you may see in inflammatory bowel disease, Clostridium difficile, ischemic conditions, and then lymphatic obstruction from cardiac lymphoma, different conditions like that. Clinical features of protein losing enteropathy would be edema, ascites, diarrhea, fat and carbohydrate loss also. Laboratory that might help with the diagnosis, low protein albumin and GABA globulins and lymphocytopenia. Tests, we don't do it very often for protein losing enteropathies, would be an alpha-1 antitrypsin clearance test. Celiac sprue, I'm going to talk a little bit more about specific diseases. Celiac sprue is probably something you'll get a fair number of questions on your boards, at least in the GI section, I would think. Patients with celiac can't tolerate a protein called gluten, which is found in wheat, rye, barley, and depending on how the oats are produced, sometimes oats. When patients eat gluten, their immune system responds by damaging the small mucosa. So there's different titles that are different names of the same condition, celiac disease, celiac sprue, gluten enteropathy, all basically meaning the same thing. Genetically inherited, associated with the HLA locus found on the short arm of chromosome 6. HLA-DQ2 is present in about 95% of patients with celiac. The pathology with this would be a flattening of the small bowel villi. So on your left is normal, and then on your right is the flattening. You can see the finger-like projections that we describe the villi, a normal villi with. You can see the flattening pretty obvious in that picture. So classic disease, there's three features that you should keep in mind. Villus atrophy, symptoms of malabsorption, and then resolution of mucosal lesions and symptoms upon withdrawal of gluten-containing foods. So if those three are all met, then the diagnosis of celiac is pretty obvious. Clinical features with celiac, there's a tremendous variation. It can be from subtle to diarrhea to atypical symptoms that I'll talk a little bit about. You can see it in childhood. You can see patients presenting in adulthood. We used to think of it classically as a child disease, but we are diagnosing a lot of people more in the adult age also. Symptoms are not specific for celiac, so you do have to have a high index of suspicion. Some patients, again, can develop as children or as adults. I recently diagnosed somebody at, I think he was 67, and that was the first diagnosis. So clinical manifestation, the classic is diarrhea, bulky, foul-smelling, floating stools due to steatorrhea and flatulence. Consequences of having malabsorption, they may have weight loss, severe anemia, neurologic disorders due to vitamin B deficiency, osteopenia due to vitamin D and calcium deficiencies. So the weight loss, some patients actually compensate by increasing their dietary intake, so you might not see obvious weight loss. In severe patients, they may have a hypoproteinemia that we talked about, so they have fluid retention, so they don't necessarily notice the weight loss. Again, nonspecific symptoms, weakness, lassitude, fatigue, nothing is specific to celiac disease. Atypical symptoms to keep in mind, nonspecific symptoms, anemia, particularly a microcytic anemia, iron deficiency anemia, and dental enamel defects, osteoporosis, arthritis, increased transaminase, so mildly elevation AST and ALT can be an atypical presentation of celiac, neurologic symptoms, fertility problems. So the anemia, just to cover some of the extraintestinal symptoms a little bit more, the anemia, most of the time it's an iron deficiency anemia, but in severe cases, you can see a B12 deficiency, so you need to look for it in both, but most cases when you're looking at anemia, it's more of an iron deficiency. Impaired coagulability due to the prothrombin deficiency from impaired vitamin K absorption, so you can see more severe situations like that also. So to diagnose celiac, there's serology that can be done as an initial screening test. You want to do all your testing when the patient is actually on a gluten-containing diet. So if a patient presents to you, because so many people are hearing about gluten-free diets now, it's the kind of craze for weight loss too, which you really don't lose weight on a gluten-free diet, but that's one of the things out there now is patients will come, at least to us, saying that I want to know if I have celiac or not, but they've already started a gluten-free diet. It's quite difficult to diagnose somebody when they've already eliminated the offending agent. So they have to be on a gluten-containing diet. And then biopsies should be performed in all patients who are suspected of having celiac, regardless of the serologic evidence. So a lot of times we'll do serology, which I'll talk about in a second, to help screen for celiac sprue, but if you have a high index of suspicion, then you should still have the patient get biopsies. There is still a small number of patients that will have positive serology also, but a normal biopsy and a negative serology does not preclude the evidence of disease. So again, still the gold standard is still to get biopsies. So screening tests to diagnose for celiac, there are a variety of antibody tests out there. There's panels of tests that you can get from different laboratories. The anti-gliadin antibodies were probably some of the first antibody testing that was out there for celiac. There is false positives. The sensitivity and specificity are listed there. It's not a test that I do regularly. Anti-endomysial antibody testing is a little bit more sensitivity and specificity. If you're doing the IgA testing, you do have to be careful. You can get false negative tests in some patients that are IgA deficient. And in young kids, it's not accurate. The recommended test now for celiac is the tissue transglutaminase antibody testing for patients over the age of 2. The sensitivity and specificity is good. I did include, where I could, the AGA, or the ACG, the American College of Gastroenterology recommendations. So that's where you see strong recommendation. I tried to include those for you. And again, if you're doing IgA testing, you do need to make sure that the patient's not IgA deficient. A lot of the tissue transglutaminase testing, at least in my area, will come IgA and IgG. So we get both tests. Then small bowel biopsies, again, positive. When do you do small bowel biopsies? They have positive serology to confirm the diagnosis. If you have a high probability of celiac, you want your endoscopist to be doing biopsies from the duodenal bulb and second and third portion of the duodenum. And again, I just listed the recommendations, which we talked about. So this is a classic picture of somebody with celiac sprue. If you can appreciate it from your distance, probably this one on your right-hand side, if you can see the scalloping of the mucosa here. If we that are endoscopists here did an endoscopy on this patient, it would be pretty obvious that they have celiac. So this is a pretty obvious picture. But the scalloping nodularity that you don't typically see in the small bowel, absence of the circular folds, those are all clues for endoscopic visualization of celiac sprue. Complications. So a lot of patients will ask, well, why can't I just go on a gluten-free diet? I feel better. What's it matter if I truly have celiac versus just a sensitivity to, say, wheat or a sensitivity to gluten, but not the true disease? There are potential complications with celiac that you would want to follow your patients for that they wouldn't have if they just have a sensitivity. So it's important to get a diagnosis. Refractory sprue is a severe complication that can develop. You can get collagenous sprue, lymphoma, ulcerative jejunitis. T-cell lymphoma is one of the scarier things that we worry about with patients with celiac that has a high mortality rate. So celiac versus non-celiac gluten sensitivities. Symptoms or response to gluten-free diet should not be used to diagnose celiac disease. A diagnosis of non-celiac gluten sensitivity should be considered only after celiac has been excluded with appropriate testing. And again, these are from guidelines from the ACG. Management of celiac disease, a gluten-free diet for life. So wheat, barley, and rye. Oats appear to be safe, but it should be introduced with caution, and it somewhat depends on how they're manufactured or processed. Patients should be referred to a registered dietitian that has knowledge in celiac. That's always a recommendation. I know in the real world it's sometimes harder to get patients into dietitians because unfortunately it's not covered by a lot of insurances, so it's a pretty high out-of-pocket cost. Okay, so a question. Try to wake you up a little bit here. A patient with celiac has followed a gluten-free diet for 6 months and was doing well, but now diarrhea has returned. Review of her diet shows that she's been compliant. Endomysial antibody testing is now normal. What's the next step? Repeat a small bowel biopsy, small bowel follow-through, CT scan of the abdomen, colonoscopy with biopsies, or bacterial aspirate of small bowel contents. So the answer is D, colonoscopy. And the reason for that is that the patient had responded to a gluten-free diet, and it's not uncommon for microscopic colitis and celiac sprue to appear together. There's about 15% of the time the two diseases actually coexist. So somebody that is compliant based on diet, based on the antibody testing, which should go back to normal if the patient's compliant, one of the things to rule out is microscopic colitis. 52-year-old, I think it was a male, 52-year-old male, recently traveled to Puerto Rico for 3 months. He developed fatigue, malaise, and abdominal cramps 1 week after returning, followed by diarrhea and dyspepsia. Stools are described as oatmeal-like. Lab shows a hemoglobin of 11.3 with an MCV of 103. Stool studies are negative. Enteroscopy is performed. What's the most likely diagnosis? Celiac sprue, Giardia, tropical sprue, or lactase deficiency? Answer is tropical sprue. So tropical sprue can mimic celiac sprue. Etiology is unknown, although it's suspected that it's an infectious etiology. Treatment is tetracycline and folate for 6 to 12 months. So if you see a question like this on a board exam, the key is the patient has diarrhea, plus they've been in the tropics somewhere, and the macrocytic anemia. So if you see those things in a question, then think tropical sprue. Different types of lactase deficiency, we touched on a little bit before. There's congenital form, which presents at birth. It's pretty rare, and it's an autosomal recessive inheritance. Primary form, genetically determined and dependent on the population. Most common would be different areas of Africa, East Asia, and the Pacific. Onset is usually delayed. And then secondary or acquired, which occurs after intestinal injury. Bacterial overgrowth is a direct consequence of the presence of increased amounts of colonic-type bacterial flora in the small intestine. It can result from fat, it can result in fat, carbohydrate, and/or protein malabsorption. May see a macrocytic anemia due to cobalamin deficiency. So the etiology of bacterial overgrowth, small bowel diverticulum, fistulas for Crohn's disease, bypass of the intestine, functional stasis like diabetes, scleroderma, things that affect the motility of the small intestine. You can diagnose it through different maneuvers. Direct aspiration is not done clinically very often, but direct aspiration of the aerobes and anaerobes from small bowel is the standard. Alternatives would be carbon dioxide and hydrogen breath tests. Therapy, if you can correct the underlying reason for the bacterial overgrowth, then correct the underlying issue. Otherwise, a trial of antibiotics, but usually it's largely empiric. Okay, switching again, whipping through stuff here. Giardia. Giardia is an intestinal infection caused by the protozoa Giardia. Predominant age that we see in the United States are either preschool children, especially in daycare settings, or homosexual men. Contaminants from fresh water are sources worldwide. So if you get a question about somebody that was hiking somewhere up in the mountains and drinking out of streams, those are all buzz things for a Giardia question. Clinical findings, about 70% of patients will have intestinal symptoms like diarrhea, flatulence, cramping, bloating, nausea. Chronic diarrhea, malabsorption, and weight loss can also be seen. About 20 to 25% of patients that are infected are actually asymptomatic. The workup would be stool studies. Stool assay for Giardia antigen is usually used. Rule out malabsorptions and B12, albumin, stool for fat test, and then treatment most common in the United States is metronidazole. Okay, a 45-year-old has had malabsorption for the past year with low volume, diarrhea, polyarthritis, and occasional visual hallucinations. Physical exam is negative. CT shows generalized lymphadenopathy. EGD shows broad flattened villi in the duodenum. A biopsy show numerous PSA positive macrophages in the submucosa. Which therapy may be used in this patient? Gluten-free diet, steroids, antibiotics, or antacids? So you have to have an idea what's going on. The answer is C, antibiotics. So that was a description of somebody with Whipple's disease. Again, something we never see in clinical practice, but a good thing for board exams. So keep that in mind. It's a rare infectious condition that that prevents small bowel from absorbing nutrients. It can affect multiple organs. So you may get a description of foamy macrophages. Most common symptoms are arthralgias, weight loss, recurrent abdominal pain, diarrhea, CNS manifestations are also classic. So, okay, so again, there's multiple vitamins and different things that I went over that I included, but it's one of those things that probably just reading it would be easier. So I'm just going to flip through here a little bit. Fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin A, D, E, and K. A, classically, is night blindness. D, nausea, vomiting, weakness. We hear a lot about vitamin D deficiency. Well, maybe not in Nevada, but where I live in Michigan, we hear a lot about vitamin D deficiency. E is neurologic symptoms, hemolysis. K, excessive bruising and bleeding. So excessive amounts of the fat-soluble vitamins can cause toxicity, so keep that in mind also. And then different minerals that you might be asked, again, just try to remember the different things that it presents with. Any are interesting here. Cardiomyopathy with selenium is a classic. And then again, you may develop deficiencies in patients receiving long-term TPN or tube feeding. So if you get a question about somebody that's been on long-term TPN and they present with a cardiomyopathy, think of the deficiency that they might have. So test yourself a little bit here. You've got vitamin A, C, K, zinc, chromium, and copper on the one side, and then which one would you see? Glucose intolerance, night blindness, hypogonadism, impaired wound healing, Menkes, which is kinky hair syndrome, which I had never heard of before, and easy bruising. And then you have the answers there, so you should have all the answers. But quiz yourself a little bit before your exams. So a little bit about nutrition. General information, when is nutrition typically beneficial? The kind of standard is if the patient, if it's a normal, previously fairly healthy patient, if they're going to go 7 to 10 days with no PO intake, then you need to consider supportive nutrition. Best indicator of malnutrition is actually unintentional weight loss during the prior 3 months. It's the only criteria to offer predictive value. If the unintentional weight loss is greater than 20% their baseline, that's considered severe protein calorie malnutrition. 10 to 20% is moderate, and less than 10% is mild. The debate versus enteral versus parenteral, if the gut works, use it. I think most people have heard that. Enteral nutrition, they are contraindications, so if you see one of these in the exam, and think of, that would be an indication for TPN use instead. So no access, bowel obstructions, severe intestinal dysmotility, high output fistulas, intractable severe vomiting or diarrhea, ischemic bowel, severe malabsorption, and obviously a patient refuses. Parenteral nutrition complications of parenteral nutrition include infections, central line thrombosis, nutrient excess or deficiency, metabolic bone disease, TPN-related hepatobiliary diseases. Refeeding syndrome can happen in severely malnourished patients who receive high glucose, high volume feedings abruptly. They can have severe electrolyte shifts. To avoid refeeding syndromes, you would add thiamine, slow the initiation of feedings with liberal amounts of electrolytes, follow the electrolytes and their clinical presentation closely, particularly when you're initially starting the feeding, and then avoid excessive use of dextrose.